We're in the middle of a series. In fact, we're coming to the end of the series. In fact, we are at the end of the series, which is counting down to the cross. So 2 weeks ago, we looked at Jesus being arrested. Last week, we looked at Jesus being tried. And this week, we look at all of the rest of chapter 19 of John's Gospel, which covers his crucifixion. And quite a long passage. Well done, Sean, for reading through that. But we've got our work cut out to get through it today. But it's the most amazing passage for us. So with God's help, we should get to the meaning of that. First, you got it, Tom? We're going to start with an exercise. There we go. Got the screen show. So you'll see, hopefully this will work. There we go. What do you think of when you see that?
Nike.
Heaven thinks of Nike. All right. I'm sure we all think of Nike. What do you think of when you see this?
Olympics.
Thank you. What do you see when you? What do you think of when you see this?
Costa.
Some of us think of Costa. And what do others of us think? Yeah, you see. What about this? Yeah, rich people who can afford a Mercedes. And what about that?
Pepsi.
See, I thought you might struggle with that. I thought I'd get this trickier one. I was going to show you about rebranding and how Pepsi, if it comes up, have managed to move from the one on the left to the one on the right. It's the science of logo. What about this? What do you think of when you see that? Christianity. Yeah, it's not a trick question. Because Christianity, like the three-pointed star of Mercedes, or like the twin-tailed mermaid of Starbucks, but you didn't know that's what it was called, but that's what the logo is called, the twin-tailed mermaid, or the Olympic rings for the Olympics, I don't think anyone could seriously dispute that if you had a logo for Christianity, it would be the cross. I think that's fair enough. Churches around the world have their floor plan on the basis of a cross, don't they? Bishops wear a large cross on their chests. As Christians, if you die as a Christian or in a Christian culture, your headstone will quite often be in the shape of a cross. You think of the World War I memorial cemeteries, cross after cross after cross. Or Christians around the world wear a cross as an item of jewellery. But it struck me that if ever there's an unlikely logo for a movement, it is the cross. Because, of course, it is the symbol of execution. I mean, imagine if the defining symbol of Christianity was this. You see, if you've got a cross necklace, how would you feel if instead of a cross, you had an exquisitely carved noose hanging on the end of it? Or how would you feel this week when you go to Marks and Spencer's to buy your hot cross buns, and you pick them up and actually they're called hot noose buns? Or how would you feel if walking past a church on Friday you hear singing from the church, "When I survey the wondrous noose on which the Prince of Glory died"? You see, it's actually a grotesque thought, isn't it? We struggle with that. But really, why is it that the manner of execution, the cross, has become the logo of Christianity in the same way that the noose would have been? And that's what we're going to think about here, where we talk about the centrality of the cross. Now, the first thing to say is that it's not actually very easy to get a logo, an abstract logo, to stand for a particular product. I mean, Rachel Shepherd, she's a marketing expert sitting amongst us here, right? And she will know the tens of millions of dollars that have gone into all of those logos that we saw right at the beginning, right, to get them to stand for a particular product. There's nothing about a twin-tailed mermaid that makes you think of coffee. So there's a lot of investment that goes into making that connection. But no one with a cross, you know, no one with some twisted sense of humour and a lot of money has associated a cross with Christianity over the years. What's happened is that the cross has achieved the fundamental rule of branding when it comes to creating logos. And that is, I was reading this week, I've become an instant expert on marketing. What you want a logo to do is instantly tell a story of the essence of the brand. It tells a story in an instant. It gets right to the heart of what it's about. So, for example, for those who like Apple products, that brushed aluminium Apple symbol, that instantly tells you things about Apple, that the product is high quality, that it's modern, that it's individual, that it's up to date, and probably lots of other things that some highly paid advertising agency has paid to get across with that snapshot of the product. And it's the same with Christianity, because the cross is the essence of Christianity. It tells us everything there is to know that's vital to know about Christianity in an instant. But how can that be? Let's look at John 19 and try and find out. So if you turn to it, if you have lost it, it's page 1088. And we're covering all three sections of this today. So we're looking at the crucifixion of Jesus, which takes us up to verse 27. Then we're looking at the death of Jesus, which takes us up to verse 37. And finally, the burial of Jesus. And if I get it to move on. Oh, there we go. And we're going to use it to answer these questions. Why is it that the cross is the very centre of Christianity? Because I think John 19 answers that question for us. And there are three things we're going to look at, which correspond to the three sections. Okay, so in the first section, as we look at the crucifixion, we'll see that the cross is Jesus' enthronement as God's true king. And then we'll look at Jesus' death in verses 28 to 37, and we'll see that the cross accomplishes God's plan to save the world. And then thirdly, in the final part, which is the burial of Jesus, we'll see how the cross transforms the hearts of his followers. So that's where we're going. We'll spend most of our time in the first two, not so long in the third one. So when you see the time drifting away, don't worry too much. There's hope. I say that for people who've heard me before. Right, let's get to the first one. So we've said here that the crucifixion of Jesus shows us that the cross is Jesus' enthronement as God's true king. On the face of it, that is a bizarre statement. How can the public humiliation of a beaten and helpless man possibly be the enthronement of someone as king? I mean, we might just accept that a noble death is consistent with being a king. Richard III's had a good week this week. You remember, he was reburied in Leicester Cathedral, wasn't he, this week? And Richard III, as everybody knows, died gloriously in battle. Relatively gloriously. He died in battle. The Battle of the Bosworth Field in 1485. And for a king, that's sort of consistent with being a king. But a death on a cross? Is that the same? Well, no, of course not, because dying on a cross is the very opposite of a noble kingly death. It was designed to be the ultimate indignity. Sometimes we forget that, I think. We think of the cross as just the way that Romans happened to kill people. You know, the Americans used an electric chair. You know, the Victorians used a noose. Henry VIII used, well, not personally, but under Henry VIII, wives were beheaded with an axe. In Roman times, it was sort of the way it was done, with a cross. Not so. Not so. That's not the way Romans killed people. They weren't interested in finding an efficient way of dispatching people. They were interested in humiliating people. It was the worst form of punishment, reserved for the worst type of criminal. I was reading this week of the way one person has described it, and I think it's important for us, because at the beginning of this chapter, it just says here that there they crucified him. Because everybody that John was writing to knew what crucifixion meant. We don't. We don't think about it. So let me read this. Crucifixion, it says here, represented the acme, which means the height, of the torturer's art. The atrocious physical sufferings, the length of torment, ignominy, the effect of the crowd gathered to witness the long agony of the crucified. Nothing could be more horrible than the sight of this living body, breathing, seeing, hearing, still able to feel, and yet reduced to the state of a corpse by forced immobility and absolute helplessness. We cannot even say that the crucified person writhed in agony, for it was impossible for him to move. Stripped of his clothing, naked, unable even to brush away the flies which fell upon his wounded flesh, already lacerated by the preliminary scourging, exposed to the insults and curses of people who can always find some sickening pleasure in the sight of the tortures of others, a feeling which is increased and not diminished by the sight of pain. The cross represented the miserable humanity reduced to the last degree of impotence, suffering, and degradation. The penalty of crucifixion combined all that in the most, all that the most ardent tormentor could desire: torture, pillory, degradation, and certain death distilled slowly. drop by drop. So how could a death of such degradation be consistent with being a king? And how, moreover, could it be the moment of his enthronement as king? Well, the answer is that this is an example. In fact, this is the supreme example of what you might call divine jiu-jitsu by God. Who knows what jiu-jitsu is? Some people know what jiu-jitsu, but not many. All right, I'm not going to ask you what it is, but jiu-jitsu is a method of combat like judo, which was developed in Japan, which uses the strength and weight of an adversary to disable him, right? So quite often people talk about a jiu-jitsu move, which is when someone's coming at you, you use their weight to your advantage, right? So there you are, divine jiu-jitsu is what I've called it. And this is entirely consistent with the way the God of the Bible acts. See, right up to this point, through the Old Testament, right up until now, we see God using contrary human behavior or impossible human situations for his particular purposes. That's just the authentic way that God acts throughout the Bible. Right from Adam and Eve in the garden, using their free will to rebel against God, which set into motion God's divine plan of salvation for humanity. Right through to Abraham and Sarah, who were way beyond childbearing age, used as the father of a great nation that would be used to bless the world. Right through to the people of Israel asking for a king, directly actually in contravention to what God had said to them. And they wanted just to be like the nations round about, which God used to show what kingship was all about. Right through to the apparently disastrous line of kings leading to the fall of Jerusalem, the exile in Babylon, and the sort of rather unpromising return of the exiles back to the land of Jerusalem, which God used to make mind-blowing promises about a greater future in store for them, involving the sending of his own Messiah to rescue and restore people to an eternal kingdom. This is what God does. God uses things that are going in the wrong direction for his glory and his purposes. So let's take a quick look here at verse 17 and 18, and you'll see here what it says. We'll try and get to the human description of what's happening, and then we'll look at the divine description. So verse 17, it says, as John read to us earlier on, if I can flip the page. Carrying his cross, Jesus went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with two others, one on each side, and Jesus in the middle. So Jesus is in the middle of three. The Romans wouldn't have thought about this for a moment, but Jesus is in the middle of three, and it's almost as if he's the king there holding court. If you've been watching Wolf Hall, you'll realise that at every point, Henry VIII has to be in the centre, because he is holding court for those around him. And God is just sort of supervising that for us, so we can see the significance of Jesus being in the very centre of these the criminals that are being crucified with him. And then we have this incident with a notice. The Pilate had a notice prepared. Now, there wasn't anything unusual about that. The authorities will quite often prepare a notice with the crime of the person to act as a warning to others not to do the same. What's different here is that Pilate himself is involved. And the wording he uses is, of course, as it says here, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. Now, for Pilate, at a human level, Pilate just does that as a bit of a taunt to the Jewish leaders, because they've actually outmaneuvered him, as we saw last week, and they've ended up with Jesus on the cross, which is a victory for them. He knows that this will rile them, because what he's trying to say is, here's the King of the Jews, this pathetic figure, hanging on a cross from Nazareth, which is sort of the lowest of the low. This is as close to a king as you can manage. You know, what contemptible people you are, he's saying to the Jewish leaders. And they object to that, but he finally, getting some backbone, ignores their protests. So that's what's happening at a human level. At a divine level, what's going on? Well, from God's eternal perspective, there's a series of events which actually result in this being the enthronement of Jesus as King of the universe. You remember last week we saw Jesus being crowned with the purple robe and the crown of thorns. Do you remember if you were here? So if that was his coronation, this is, so to speak, his enthronement as king. The whole of John's Gospel actually has been leading up to this point. We've come in sort of at the end, but if you know the Gospel, you'll be aware that part one, which takes up the first 12 or so chapters, and ends with actually the triumphal entry into Jerusalem that we're celebrating today, Palm Sunday. That's where it ends. And that's all about showing Jesus' credentials as king, signs and explanations from Jesus. And then part two begins with Jesus saying in chapter 12, verse 23, "The hour has come," he says. "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." And he goes on to explain what that means. He says, "Now the ruler of the world will be cast out, and I, when I'm lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." And to help us understand what that means, John says he said this to show what kind of death he was going to die. See, Jesus starts thinking about his death. The second half of the gospel begins with Jesus announcing that he is going to die, and that he's going to die by lifting up. Now, the significance of this wouldn't have been lost on John's readers, but it might be for us because we don't really understand the process of execution, what happens. But what would happen is that the executed person, having carried their cross, which is the crossbar of the cross, not the whole thing, they would carry it, it would be laid on the ground, they would lie flat with their back on that crossbar, and their nails would be driven through their wrists, and they would be lashed to that crossbar, and then they would have the agony of being lifted up vertically onto the vertical post, which is left there, actually. They would, at these execution sites, they would keep a vertical post there. And what's being said here is that it is the lifting up of Jesus, which is like his enthronement. He's high, he's visible, he's above the heads of the people. Jesus is being lifted up, he's being enthroned. And as we can see here, if you go back to chapter 19, you'll see it's a very public moment, just like an enthronement of a king. See verse 20, how it says here that many of the Jews read this sign because it was the place that Jesus was crucified was near the city. See, it was close to the city centre. It wasn't a kind of sideshow somewhere that was happening kind of off limits to everybody else. And see how the sign was written in three languages. Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. It was written in Aramaic, which is the local language that people spoke. It was written in Latin, which is the language of the empire and the language of the army. And it was written in Greek, which was the language of commerce and culture. It's almost as if we're supposed to see here that this is appealing to everybody. In an age before mass communication, this is as close to mass communication as you get. This is, you know, this is a new king being enthroned and everybody in the kingdom being informed of that fact. So that's what this is. This is the enthronement of Jesus. But that does leave us with this question. Well, how is it that this could be the enthronement? What is it about Jesus here that means that he is enthroned as king? Well, the Bible tells us that two things, I think, in particular. The first is that Jesus is enthroned as king because of his obedience. He is the true king because he was obedient to death, even death on a cross. You know Philippians 2? Therefore, God highly exalted him. It was his obedience to death, even death on a cross, that led to his exaltation, his glorification. And I think if you contrast that, it sort of only really came home to me when I realized, you know, there were a long line of kings of Israel and Judah. A long line. And what was the thing that they all failed at? Every single one, good and bad alike, they all failed on this point of obedience. Most of them failed, actually, because they were self-serving and ego-driven and they wanted to be served by people. But others even thought they knew best. Kings like Josiah and Hezekiah. In the end, they thought actually there were areas where they would know better than God. If you know the stories, you might know what I mean there. But they thought they might know better. Jesus, the Bible tells us, John's Gospel, very clear, constantly lived in obedience to God, his Father. And he was obedient to death, even death on a cross. Secondly, of course, it's on the cross that Jesus wins the decisive victory. You know, we've talked about the Battle of Bosworth Field. And Henry Tudor won a decisive victory, which meant that he was king. It was the victory that led to his enthronement as king. And it's the same here. Jesus wins a decisive victory. Will reminded us of Colossians 2, verse 15, where it says that Jesus disarmed the powers and authorities, making a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them. Triumphing, not an easy word to say, triumphing over them on the cross. You know, this was Jesus' victory. won on the cross decisively. So that's the first reason that the cross is so central. Jesus is publicly announced as God's king, and he's enthroned as God's true king, even though it doesn't look like it. So as I say, it's what you might call divine jiu-jitsu. Secondly, the cross accomplishes God's plan to save the world.
Excuse me for a second.
And this is the section called the death of Jesus. If you look at that, it begins at verse 28 through to verse 37. We're not going to look at all of it, but I just want to highlight something at the beginning. Because it says here, later, knowing that everything had been finished, and so the scripture would be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I'm thirsty." And he takes a drink of wine vinegar. I take it it was partly here to moisten his lips because he was about to say something. In fact, we know from the other Gospels that he shouts something out. And what does he shout? He shouts, "It is finished. It is finished." And then Jesus bows his head. The Greek word is very deliberate, actually, that he bows his head. He doesn't slump. He bows his head and he gives up his spirit and dies. Now notice what that doesn't say. It doesn't say, you know, it's not Jesus saying, "I'm finished." Nor does Jesus say, "It's over." He deliberately says, "It is finished." And I was reading this week that the word used here, the Greek word, is a word called tetelestai. And that word was apparently the word that was written on receipts that had been paid in the ancient world. So when something was paid out, a loan was paid off or something like that, finally something had been paid, it would have stamped on it the word tetelestai. It's finished. It's over. If you were an ancient Greek and you'd paid off your student loan, you might say with a final moment, "It is finished." You might say tetelestai. Or if you finally get to the age of 75 and you pay off your mortgage, I'll be saying, I can think of it, tetelestai, it is finished. Or if you're the captain of the Australian cricket team, who are probably celebrating today, they've been on a mission to win the Cricket World Cup, they've won it today, they would be saying, if they were around in the ancient world, they'd be saying, tetelestai, it is finished, it's over, the mission is accomplished, I've done it. And that's what Jesus is saying here, mission accomplished, it's finished. The cross is the achievement of God's plan, it's the fulfillment of God's plan to save the world. Well, we need to understand what that means. And in verses chapters 18 and 19, probably best if we started to sort of consider what Jesus means by his mission. If we start in chapter 1, we'd hear John the Baptist when he saw Jesus saying, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." But even in these last couple of chapters that we've been studying for the last couple of weeks, there are things that tell us about Jesus' mission. What did he mean when he said, you know, "It is finished, mission accomplished"? Well, there's Rupert there. So Rupert was telling us a couple of weeks ago about... Rupert was telling us about Jesus drinking the cup of God's wrath. Do you remember that? We were looking about the fact that Jesus was in control. He knew what was ahead of him. And at the time when, you might remember this, Simon Peter cuts the ear of the high priest's servant, Jesus puts him right and he says, "No. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" And that wasn't just a sort of idiomatic way of saying, "Shall I not go ahead and, you know, face into the future and deal with the nasty things that'll happen?" It was a deliberate reference to the Old Testament, which depicts a cup as being the cup of God's wrath, the cup of God's judgment against people that have rebelled against him, sinful people, God's enemies. And Jesus is saying, "No, my mission is to drink that cup, drink it down to its dregs, and to take on the punishment that other people should have." That's what Jesus sees as his mission. And at this moment when he says, "It is finished," surely that's what's in his mind. That he has drunk the cup of God's judgment down to its dregs. Even though he is the one person who should not be judged by God, because he has always lived a sinless life. He has never been in rebellion against God. He has perpetually been in communion with God. But he himself is willing to drink this cup. He's taken on the judgment that you and I should have. And one other thing we saw, this is in chapter 18, verse 14, was a reference to the high priest Caiaphas and the fact that he had advised the Jewish leaders that one man had to die for the people. Which John records as a kind of unwitting reference to explain what Jesus' death would achieve. One person would die so that other people didn't need to. And that resonates with Jesus' teaching throughout John's Gospel. For example, the I am a good shepherd passage, where Jesus talks about the shepherd laying down his life for his sheep. Laying down his life for other people, voluntarily, willingly, giving up his life so that others would live. It is finished. That's what Jesus has in mind. Now, we don't have time to look at the rest of that section about Jesus' death, but it's full of imagery about the Passover lamb. It takes place at the time of Passover. And none of the bones are broken, which was a key instruction for Passover sacrifice, the lamb. And that lamb, which was sacrificed in place of the people. Again, we don't have time to go into that, but if you did have time, we'd be able to look at that and see just how this passage is full of resonance about how Jesus' mission is dying for other people, on behalf of other people, to have access to God. And we also don't have time to look at the prophecies that Jesus fulfills in this passage. But Jesus' mission is to take on the punishment of sinners. That's what he did. That's what he achieved on the cross. So when he says it is finished, that's what he means. It accomplishes God's plan to save the world. Final point. It transforms the hearts of his hearers, of Jesus' followers. The burial of Jesus. So very briefly, I'll cover this quite quickly. But I just want to point out a couple of things that are relevant here. So if you look at that section, the burial of Jesus, one thing that comes across quite strongly is that Jesus is dead. Three times it says here, it refers to the body of Jesus. The body of Jesus. After all, a sacrifice wouldn't be effective as a sacrifice if the sacrifice offering continued to exist. You know, if you were, in the Old Testament, if you were giving a grain offering and you continued to benefit from the grain afterwards and just took it away and consumed it yourself, then clearly that's not a sacrifice, is it? And if a sacrificial lamb isn't sacrificed, then it's not effective. It needs to be killed. It needs to be consumed. It needs to be offered to God wholly. It's important that Jesus is dead. But it's also important that Jesus is dead because John is careful to guard against any misunderstanding that in some way that Jesus has just kind of swooned or he's just fainted. Or he's not really dead. It was something that the disciples made up. It says, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body away, accompanied by Nicodemus. The two of them wrapped Jesus' body in accordance with the Jewish burial customs. And then they laid Jesus in the tomb. Jesus' body. Jesus is dead. Second, look at the quantity of myrrh and spices that are used. I'm trying to find it here. Myrrh and aloes. 34, it says, what does it say? I need a bit more light here so I can see I'm getting old. 35 kilograms. Look at that, verse 39. 35 kilograms. Now, I don't know what 35 kilograms means to you, but I do wonder, actually, how Nicodemus had got that to the grave. Because 35 kilograms, he wouldn't have been allowed on British Airways with 35 kilograms, would he? Right? What's that? 20 kilograms you can take on. So it's another 15 kilograms on top of that. It is a lot of aloes and spices. A lot. A lot. Think of the luggage you'd have to carry those in, right? It's also very high value. You won't get this from here, but someone has calculated that in today's money it would cost about $200,000 to have this amount of myrrh and spices. Myrrh and aloes, burial spices. $200,000. Why are we being told this? We're being told that Jesus is buried as a king. Nobody normal would have that kind of burial. Nobody. But these disciples, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, recognized that actually in his death, Jesus was king. And he deserved to be buried as a king. And look, this is my last point, but look at who they are, right? Joseph, and the way they're described by John. Joseph of Arimathea was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, because he feared the Jews. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who had earlier visited Jesus at night. Not because he was too busy working during the day, but because he was frightened, like Joseph of Arimathea. He was frightened of the Jewish authorities. And he'd been secretly following Jesus until now. And you ask yourself, well, why is it, at the moment when they have nothing whatsoever to gain from coming out into the open as followers of Jesus, why now do they declare themselves, they go public, they go to Pilate, a high-risk move, and say, we'd like to bury the body of Jesus. Well, I think John is inviting us to see here that it's Jesus' death on the cross that has transformed them. It's the power that has transformed them. And it's true for us today. The cross of Jesus is what we sing about. All our songs tonight are about the cross of Jesus. The cross of Jesus is what we celebrate. The cross of Jesus is what we want over our grave when we're buried. The cross of Jesus is at the heart of Christianity. The cross of Jesus. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, in many ways we are awed by what we've been thinking about today. Your death on the cross, in our place, the fulfillment of your eternal plan to save us. We ask that as we celebrate communion this evening, and we ask that as we prepare for Easter this week, you will fire our hearts with the amazing truth of your love for us. Amen.